We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds.
Engage.
Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Sailing frequencies open, sir.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Deck 44 for another episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Hoffman, at J Hoffman on Twitter. Facebook is Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, dot Facebook dot something or other. I don't know. But we got a great episode. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been here on Deck 44. I was away. I was down in Florida, Brian. I was with my niece and nephew at Universal Studios Florida.
Really?
And, you know, they got the Spider-Man ride, they got the Minions ride, they got the friggin' Shrek ride.
They got a lot down there.
Where they got the King Kong ride. Where the heck's the Star Trek ride?
That's a good question. That would be great for someday.
It's in Germany. They have a Star Trek ride in Germany, and it's a roller coaster. It's not like one of these... Universal, it's a lot of like screens and 3D, but the line, I know it's like I watched the art. There was a video of the German new Star Trek ride, and it was like, yeah, roller coaster. But the line is where it's at. You know, all the Starfleet stuff, and it looks really cool. So you got to go to Germany, and one day they'll have the one in Jordan they're talking about. You know, there's been they're talking about doing like a Star Trek theme park as part of a world in a theme park that's going to be about all of human history. So like ancient history, Roman history, you know, and then also the future. And the future is allegedly going to be Star Trek themed.
Interesting.
Yeah, because
to go from real history to, you know, science fiction.
Yeah. I mean, because the president, the king of Jordan, Hussein was the father. The son is named King Abdullah. Is a huge Star Trek fan.
He had a
non-speaking role on Voyager.
Really?
Yes, he did. He's such a Star Trek fan. He was then Prince Abdullah. He was in California, and he said, they're like, Prince Abdullah, what do you want to do? The State Department, what do you want to do when you're here in America? I want to go to the Star Trek set. This is true. I'm not making this up. So they brought Prince Abdullah to the set of Voyager, and they said, Prince Abdullah, we have a costume for you. And he put on the costume, and they said, guess what? We're shooting. You're an extra today. And he has a line. Harry Kim says something to him, and he nods. It's on YouTube. I wrote about it. There's a One Trek Mind column about it on StarTrek.com.
Is he playing a human or is he playing an alien?
He plays a human.
Okay.
And he is. Harry Kim gives him an order, and he gives him a nod like an aye aye. He couldn't speak because he wasn't in the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh.
So he had to just nod. That's one of the weirdest little footnotes in Star Trek.
Seriously.
Speaking of footnotes in Star Trek, today's episode is about something that I hold very dear. We're going to talk about Star Trek music. I don't mean like the scores or, you know, I'm not talking about James Horner's brilliant score to Wrath of Khan. We're talking about William Shatner's The Transformed Man. We're talking about Leonard Nimoy's folk singing career. When you love something, as we love Star Trek, we love it all. And we find a way to embrace the unembraceable. So we're going to have a great guest on. We're going to dial in through the magic of Skype our friend Nathan Rabin, who is a pop culture critic and has made a bit of a career of himself finding the things to love in what is frequently reviled. He's written about things of this nature for his whole career. So Nathan is a chum and a colleague that I've known for a very long time, and I've wanted to have him on the show for a long time. So that's going to be happening soon. But before we do that, we have two pieces of business to take care of. One, I've been on the show for a while. There were some new Discovery images. Red alert! Red alert! We have some new images that came out of Discovery. They're in Entertainment Weekly. By now, it's old news. It was a few days ago. Number one, we saw the captain, Jason Isaacs, captain of the Discovery, in his uniform. He looks great. Doesn't he look great? He looks blue.
He does look blue.
Well, he doesn't look blue. His uniform is blue.
Uniform is blue with the gold trim.
And the lighting behind him is blue. You don't really see. They're still holding the reveal of the bridge of the Discovery, but you can kind of see it out of focus, impressionistic painting over his shoulders, and it looks fabulous. Now, the other thing you see is, I didn't know what the heck it was until I read the caption, but we saw the transporter room. And I'm very curious about that because it didn't look like any teleporter I'd seen before. It looked like what is the part of a speaker, the one that on the bottom, like a woofer?
Subwoofer.
The thing that's like a circular? You know, like the circular bit at the bottom of a speaker? It looked like that. It looked like a deflector dish or a woofer. Or a tweeter, or whatever the heck it is. I don't know much about stereo systems.
I probably should, but...
all I know is that is I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, they're in some weird room. It looked like a roller rink from the 70s. I'm like, what is this weird roller rink, gold and black, weird-looking room? And it's like, that's the transport room? And I went like, what the hell are you talking about? And I said, you know what? It's one shot. I'm really curious to see what the heck's going on. So it did the job. It got me curious. I recognize the fact that Discovery's transporter room is going to look like Discovery's transporter room. It's not going to look like the transporter room we expect, but if it looks cool, that's the way it's going to be. You know, bring it on. You know, let's see some changes. Let's see some new stuff, for God's sakes. Now,
is there? Don't we have another piece of news too? A premiere date?
Yes. Yes, well, we always knew it was going to be fall, and now we officially have the date of September 24th.
So less than 3 months.
Oh, my God. September 24th. Now I'm getting nervous. September 24th is coming up, and it's going to be on regular CBS.
That is correct.
Episode 1. Episode 2 is going to air, is going to be available that same night on All Access.
Yes.
Unless you live in England, in which case it's the next day, I think.
That part, I don't know.
Yeah, you got to check. You know, we'll get between now and then, I will be fully briefed and then you will be fully briefed. So don't panic just yet. But when the time comes, we're going to know. Allegedly, we're going to know a lot more when things are going on. But for right now, we're just right there with you. We got 3 months to prepare to look at every image on Entertainment Weekly and salivate. It's starting to look cool. Now, if you're like me, you are so excited by these images of Star Trek Discovery that you want to save them on your computer, Brian.
I certainly do.
And what if you don't have enough room on your hard drive?
Well, maybe you should get a new one, a better, faster one.
As you may or may not know, this show is currently sponsored by WD. What the heck does WD stand for?
Western Digital.
Western Digital. WD, Western Digital, is the makers of the greatest and most reliable and well-priced external hard drives and solid-state hard drives that you could imagine. And with WD, you are now able to get solid-state drives and hard drives to fit your unique needs. When you add the superior performance of a WD solid-state drive to your PC, you get, write this down, you get blazing read speeds so you can boot your system quickly or load games and other applications in a snap. You can keep all 7 seasons of Next Generation on there. Combined with a reliable WD hard drive, you get up to 6 terabytes of storage to keep your games library, direct feed videos, podcasts, and more all in a single place. For a limited time, engaged listeners, that's you, can get 20% off select WD solid state drives with the coupon code WDENGAGE. Would engage. It's all one word. WDENGAGE. Capital letters, probably. Would engage is the actual code. To find out more at wd.com/engage. And as I mentioned, it is a select amount of solid-state drives. 250 gigabyte, 500 gigabyte, The blue, the black one. You got to look at them specifically, the ones on WD.com/engage. Great way to keep your stuff in a separate place. So if you drop your laptop one too many times, you got your stuff stored. Woof. So with that, we got a lot going on this show. Let's get right to it. We're going to talk to our friend Nathan and reflect on the musical stylings of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back, and this is very exciting.
Working.
We have on the line, on the communicator, a guest that I've wanted to have on the show pretty much since we started this. I said one of these days we're going to do an episode about an aspect of Star Trek fandom that is sometimes misunderstood. You know, when you love something like we love Star Trek, we love it all. And even the stuff that other people kind of make fun of, we don't exactly think it's great, but we like it in a way that's different. And there is one man out there in the world of pop culture that understands things that are bad in a way that few others do, that embraces failure in a way that no one else can. And I speak, of course, of the man who's really made a career out of writing about flops. He has the world of flops, the life of flops, the year of flops. We're talking about Nathan Raven, of course. Nathan, you're on the phone, right?
Oh, my goodness. I certainly am. Oh. You cannot see me, but I'm blushing. I'm a deep shade of red at your incredibly generous introduction.
Well, you know, Nathan has been a pop culture writer for a zillion years, a zillion Earth years. He's written for, you know, every outlet around for many, many years, was a head writer at AV Club and, you know, has a string, you know, writes for Vanity Fair sometimes now, and writes for Rotten Tomatoes, and also writes for his own website, which is at NathanRabin.com, which is called Nathan Rabin's Happy Place. And has written a number of books, including a coffee table book about Weird Al Yankovic, and also a book that I think kind of ties into what we're going to talk about today. The title is You Don't Know Me, But You Hate Me, right? Is that the correct title?
You Don't Know Me, But You Don't Like Me.
Right.
See, but it's appropriate. I always try and write a book title that nobody can remember or get correctly. That's always my aim.
I made it a little more violent. I went from You Don't Like Me to You Hate Me, which is even worse.
Yeah.
Which is Nathan's...
probably wouldn't be terribly inaccurate either, considering the subject matter.
This book is a celebration of two very hardcore subcultures that you may not know, but you may dislike. And one of them, which is a great bonding experience for Nathan and I, is the fandom of Phish, with a band that I love, and they love Star Trek, by the way, so there's a nice connective tissue there. But and Nathan went to his first Phish show ready to roll his eyes and became a huge fan. And also about the Insane Clown Posse, which is where Nathan and I maybe part company a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, again, you went to your first ICP show just going, who are these weirdos, the following, what are they called, the Gathering, and the Juggalos and all that. And
I just discovered that this year's they're gonna have in addition to Vanilla Ice, who's long time been a member of the family but never actually I've never seen him perform live, which is a terrible shortcoming in my life, but there's gonna be a
have seen him perform live. When he went through his metal phase, I saw it like once or twice, I think, actually.
Oh my God! One of my favorite all-time live performances was MC Hammer at the Gathering of the Juggalos. It was literally like 4:30 in the afternoon. You know, it's MC Hammer, so he was probably 53 years old, but he was performing as if his life depended upon it.
Wow!
It was like an almost transcendent experience. So yeah, you never really know. And this year there's going to be water parks and a Juggalo ventriloquist.
Wow.
So that might change your mind. That might get you to head on out to Oklahoma City this year.
Wow. Well, you know, in your book, which I read, I voraciously read, you make a really strong case about Juggalo fandom being, in a way, kind of cool and nice, and they really do reach out to people that feel that they're not respected in other spheres. And then you got to the bit where you said, the big question you want to know is, do I actually like the music? And you confessed that, although you recognize that it is not perhaps the most, you know, from a musicology or music theory point of view, it may not be the most complex or intricate, you actually do eventually grow to like ICP's music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I come to love them. Not everything that they do, but I come to really enjoy their music. I come to really enjoy their performances. I come to actually be as excited about sort of the music itself as the sort of crazy culture that kind of built up around them.
Well, you know, I do not sympathize. I empathize, because if you strap me to a lie detector, the truth of the matter is that there are some songs recorded by Leonard Nimoy that are actually, I find, to be quite moving, particularly his recording of You Are Not Alone, which was an original track that he recorded on his first album, that I genuinely think of is a good song that moves me emotionally. And when Nimoy died, I wrote an obituary for him in The Guardian, and I cited that as an example of perhaps fandom gone amok, but some of his music really isn't all that bad. Now, when you get to William Shatner, that's another story. So today we're going to talk about the Golden Throats. Today we're going to talk about our two great heroes in Star Trek, Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, who both at the height of Star Trek's popularity, right at the offset, began recording careers. And they have been both duly mocked for it ever since. Shatner a little bit more than Nimoy, but Shatner's come around and was able to turn that into part of his appeal. And you know, he had a little bit of a renaissance in the early 2000s. So you know, it's something that we as the Star Trek podcast have to embrace and accept and find a way to love. So. So that's what it is. So Nathan, let me ask you, when did you first hear the music of Leonard Nimoy and or William Shatner?
That is a good question. I think I first heard the music of Leonard Nimoy was all of the music on my iTunes was wiped out. So I borrowed, accessed legally, of course. I would never illegally download music. Somebody else's thing. And one of the things that they had was a Leonard Nimoy greatest hits. So this is weird. Even before I kind of had, you know, sort of the semi-assignment to listen to all this music for this podcast, I had listened to Leonard Nimoy before. And as you sort of said, there's something really striking about it. There are a couple of things that I think make this worth revisiting, one of which is it's incredibly personal. You really get the sense that Leonard Nimoy is trying to convey something to the world about who he is, how he sees humanity, how he sees the universe. And on one hand, it's kind of silly and kind of pretentious. The other hand, it's kind of endearing, because there's just this weird sincerity that you don't necessarily expect from a novelty album where half of the songs are in character as Spock.
Yeah.
Couple other things that really struck me is the production, you know, sort of the arrangements are just really lush and really professional. And I found myself thinking, like, if I was a viola player, a session musician, you know, in 1967, they're like, who am I playing the viola for this afternoon? It's going to be Eddie Arnold. Is it going to be Elvis Presley? Is it going to be, you know, Dolly Parton? And they're like, nah, there's a dude who plays an alien on TV. he's going to do some folk songs and you're going to back him up. I'm like, yeah, whatever. So that I found really, really fascinating, that it's such a, again, such a weirdly sincere bit of, you know, television cross promotion from 1967.
Well, that's how it definitely started. It started as television cross promotion and then it evolved. I'll take you through the history of how these albums started. And from back in the day, You know, Nimoy did the first one, and then Shatner did one, and then Shatner did only one, because what could top the transformed man? And then Nimoy did...
Probably Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Heart Club. You know? It's the same misconceived spoken word Shakespeare album.
It really is. But then Nimoy did four more, believe it or not. And then it subsided. And then they both did some additional albums, if you root around, some spoken word stuff. And then later in their careers, they went back to recording in unique ways. Nimoy founded with John DeLancey Q, the Alien Voices label, which did like audio books, kind of like theater of the mind audio books with sound effects. And then Shatner, when he was in his Priceline negotiator, Denny Crane persona, did some kind of tongue-in-cheek goofy albums that were, to me, kind of smacked of Tommy Wiseau of The Room saying, oh yeah, that was only a joke, I was only kidding, and did some kind of intentionally goofy stuff. It was kicked off, believe it or not, by Ben Folds. He was the first one that brought him back to
The Has-Been album.
Yeah, The Has-Been album. But that's
an interesting album, because that's another thing too, where there's a weird element of sincerity to it, where part of it is kind of this weird camp, and then part of it also is sort of this, like, I genuinely think that William Shatner thinks of himself as a poet, in addition to being a thespian. He's serious about this in a way that's sad and interesting and fascinating, kind of all at the same time.
Well, the thing about Shatner is he never wants anyone to forget that he is a classically trained actor, and he did do Shakespeare as a young man in Canada, and you know, I think that, and he said this himself, if you watch his movie The Captains, he always, you know, wondered if he was sullying himself a tiny bit by doing episodic television, whereas Patrick Stewart was always took it very seriously from the get-go. And, you know, having seen Shatner's one-man show on Broadway, you know, he is a good storyteller. You know, he does get very poetic. And when we get to the late 70s part of their recording career, we can talk about the amazing video of him doing the spoken word version of Rocket Man, which is a pop culture milestone nonpareil, I would say. But my own personal experience was the first album, which was called the actual title is Leonard Nimoy Sings Songs. Oh, I had the link up here for a moment.
Yeah, it's one of the most ponderous titles.
Yeah, no, I should have it memorized. Leonard Nimoy Presents Mr. Spock's Music from Outer Space, which is
by Star Trek.
Right, which was the first album that was put out Desilu when Star Trek started. Even though the ratings weren't high, it always had a tremendous following, and they knew that they could cross-market this, so they Desilu / Paramount / blah, blah, blah. There was a subsidiary recording company that they could all do it sort of in-house, and they put out this album, and the cover was Leonard Nimoy in the guise of Mr. Spock holding a model of the Enterprise, and the album was about a third instrumentals of with very 60s pop to that were reminiscent of Star Trek songs, and we'll get to that in a moment. Then there were some novelty songs that were either funny or like spoken word science fiction, including Journey to a Strange Planet, which is like almost Twilight Zone-y. And then finally, there was a couple of just covers of what was popular at the time, including Where Is Love from the show Oliver Twist, which was a popular song at the time. Now, I uncovered this later. I was not old enough for this. And the first time I heard this music was there was a repackaging of this album on cassette, if you can imagine such a thing.
Ooh, exciting.
Called cassette. And it was called You Are Not Alone. And it was basically most of this album with a couple things cut off. So it was a very short cassette. And I bought it kind of as a goof because I was huge into Star Trek at the time. This would have been just as TNG had started, but, you know, I was still rediscovering the original series, and I was obsessed with it. So I bought this, and it was also in the cheap bin. So I figured, how bad it can be. It's $3.99. So the first thing that you hear, was the theme from Star Trek, which you got to remember for people listening that are younger. We didn't have access to YouTube and Spotify and all that crap. If you wanted to hear this theme from Star Trek on your own, you couldn't just do it. You couldn't just will it. You had to have it somewhere in physical form. So I'm like, yeah, I'll spend $4 and have this because it'll be a theme from Star Trek. But actually, I soon discovered, much to my delight, that it was not the typical theme. It went a little something like, Brian, do we have the one that's called? Yeah. All right. So dig this. This is like monkeys. And there's like the groovy Hammond organ. And here we go. So that's like the twangy guitar version of the Alexander Courage theme. And what happened was, let's just let it play through for a few more seconds. Because we get some vocals coming in. Brian, let's crank it just for a moment. All right, that's enough, that's enough. So when I was a young lad, I was 12, 13, something like that, my initial thought was I was at first a little bit annoyed because it wasn't the actual theme from the show. I felt that I'd been duped by this cassette that I bought. But then I immediately recognized that this kind of like swinging groovy rocking version was actually kind of good. And like the drums were kind of kick ass. There's like a little bit at the end where there's like a drum break and a drum break, and it kind of goes like wipe out a little bit. And I was like, this is actually good. And I would play it for friends who would mock me incessantly. But I'm like, this kind of rocks a little bit, doesn't it? And of course they said no. But nevertheless, I was deeply, deeply delighted by it. And there were a couple of other instrumental. The instrumentals are the ones that really had friends mocking me. Let me, Brian, would you play this for a moment? The one that was called Where No Man Has Gone Before. All right, so it starts off just like traditional in the show. All right, so pretty straightforward. And we start to hear electric bass in there. It's not quite as it is, but still that viola player that Nathan mentioned is getting his payday here. Now, so I don't even know what instrument that is. Is that like an electric recorder, or is that just like an early synthesizer?
Sounds like The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
So this has got like a little bit of that late 60s sort of pop psychedelic incense and peppermints thing going on. But Nathan, here come the vocals. If you want to sing along, let's crank this, Brian. Okay. All right, that's enough. I tell you, I brought this tape with me to summer camp, and I was beaten to a pulp when it was. Everyone else was listening to Metallica. What does that make you think of, Nathan, when you hear this type of instrumentation of the Star Trek
Honestly,
theme?
When I think of that, I also was very impressed by it. When I think of it, I think about like kind of nuggets. I think about kind of garage rock. From the late 60s, the mid 60s, kind of have that Hammond organ. You have that kind of like funky, dirty kind of sound. I remember, you know, listening to that. They also have a kind of similar version of the Mission Impossible theme. And thinking like, if I was a DJ, that would be like a really cool thing to sample. Because it sounds familiar, but it also sounds weird and off at the same time. It's interesting, actually, kind of thinking about this. I recently read the memoir from Bob Crane's son.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It was a similar sort of thing where he was a drummer, you know, like that was kind of his thing before, you know, he became a DJ. So he also had his own novelty album, and it consisted of him playing the drums for a series of TV show theme songs. And I remember looking at that thinking how incredibly stupid and pointless, but I hadn't thought about what you just said about the YouTube thing, whereas if you wanted to hear, you know, I don't know, the Gilligan's Island theme song, outside of the context of watching Gilligan's Island, you probably like this would be a pretty good thing to do. And it's also a testament to how insane people were for Bob Crane, for Leonard Nimoy, yeah, for William Shatner, that they would spend good money for such bizarre, such kind of surreally misconceived projects.
Yeah,
they're strange mutations, all of them.
But not only when you say the wanting to hear it and, you know, didn't have access to it, like, it was a good thing to slip in one of these instrumentations if you were making a mixtape for for, like, kind of the weird girl that you had a crush on because she, you know, had a weird earring or something like that, and you know, thought, should we get a kick? You know, you throw in a couple of Depeche Mode songs and then, you know, that instrumentation with the vocals of Where No Man Has Gone Before, you know, that'll win you a lot of points, maybe.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, I'm doing one of the projects for my website, Nathan Raven's Happy Place, is a thing called The Weird Accordion to Al. And in it, I'm writing about every single Weird Al song in chronological order. I'm on 46 now. I've got about 140 more left to go. And on one of his albums, he put in a completely straight-faced cover of George of the Jungle.
Don't I know it? That was my favorite cut on the album.
Totally. And at the time, and like looking back, I'm like, well, that's kind of weird that he only did one straight cover and it was for a cartoon theme song. But that's how I was introduced to George of the Jungle. I remember, you know, the 97 Brendan Fraser movie came out. I'm like, oh, they made a movie based on that Weird Al song from 20 years ago. So I think it's sort of TV theme songs have this sort of intense nostalgic power for people, just as television shows from their youth have this incredible power. And I think that's one of the reasons why hearing an instrumental version of an old theme song can be a weirdly moving, emotional, and like interesting thing to do.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because first of all, I remember when first hearing George of the Jungle and getting into an argument with a friend because we're like, what is that? You know, what is it a parody of? And this one guy was like, no, it's just pure Weird Al, man. He's just weird. And I'm like, no, it's got to be from something. And I remember asking my parents, and they told me what it was. My mom did. And also, I remember my mother singing the theme to Mr. Ed to me as a kid.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And I was convinced that she was making it up to spoof me. And I'm like, she's like, no, when I was a kid, we watched this show about a talking horse. I'm like, you're out of your mind. And she would sing this. I'm like, you're just making these lyrics up as you go along. And we had to call like a cousin, like, you know, that was my mom's age, and be like, did you really watch a show called Mr. Ed? And the cousin's like, yeah, of course we did. Everybody watched Mr. Ed when we were kids. I'm like, oh, boy, you know, this is it's a hell of a thing. So, you know, without the internet, You had to be in touch with your relatives, you know? I mean, ridiculous, right?
That's true, yeah. And again, like, yeah, God, I love Mr. Ed. And just hearing you mention it, like, the theme song goes through my head. And I know it. Like, I've forgotten pretty much everything over the last 41 years, except for the lyrics to Mr. Ed. Mr. Ed. And there was apparently supposed to be a gritty reboot in the 90s. Jack Tandy, who's a real genius, one of the great comedy writers, and Drake Sapp, they were behind it and never got off the ground. And I would love to either watch the YouTube clip or see the script. Mr. Ed of today?
What would the gritty Mr. Ed reboot be like? Like a post-apocalyptic Mr. Ed?
Probably as like a rapper as the voiceover this time out.
Oh, man. So listen, one more of these. So we're still talking about the first album, which I knew of as You Were Not Alone. But then as far as the instrumentals, Brian, can we hear the clip which is called Beyond Antares? First of all, what is that sound that I'm hearing? It's a harp and a woman's voice. And now we got those keyboards. And listen to this synthesizer. Oh, no, that's the flute. Now, hardcore fans already know what we're hearing. But if you're having trouble placing it, let's play it through for a moment and hear that synthesizer, because it's like a soothing, comforting pillow to me. Oh, yes. I swear to God, I wore this tape through. I wore it so hard that you could hear side B as you were playing side A.
Wow.
Okay, so let's cut it off. So what you're hearing there, for hardcore fans that know, that's a song that Uhura sings. If you, you know, Uhura, of course, was established as a singer in the episode Charlie X, but she continued to sing. Now, if you remember the episode Conscience of the King, one of my favorite ones from season one, that is what she sings to Riley as he's being given poison milk because he's lonely at his station by himself. And so she sings it over the intercom. And then it shows up again in The Changeling, Scott Movie Mance's favorite episode. No, that's not The Changeling that he loves. He loves Metamorphosis. But anyway, she sings it in that one too before she gets her memory wiped. So when I was falling in love with the original series, I hadn't seen those episodes yet before I bought this tape. Because, you know, in reruns, they played around. So I heard the song and I just thought it was like generic 60s vaguely sci-fi melody that was on this tape for no reason. And then I got to these episodes and I'm like, oh, that's the song that I know. It's got lyrics too and everything. So it was a heavy day for me, man. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
So that was the first Leonard Nimoy album, and it was predominantly in the persona of Mr. Spock. And as his five albums proceeded, he would deviate a little bit. His second album is called Two Sides of Leonard Nimoy, and it was the first side A was all Spock stuff, which included humor, and then side B were the folk songs. But before we get to that,
let's. I feel like I should correct you. You refer to Leonard Nimoy's music as both funny and containing humor. I would just like to say that those should both be in quotation marks.
Wait.
Because they're funny. They're humor. He's being clever. More so than it's like, yeah. Although I did laugh a lot at William Shatner. Never intentionally.
Wait. You didn't laugh at all during Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth?
Well, I'm not sure if I. There's such a thing as laughing with an at. I think I might have done some combination of the two with Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth.
That one contains one of the weirdest pop culture references that if you did not. If you had to have lived through the year 1968. And it couldn't have been later than 1971 because you would have had to look it up. What he's talking about, the corned beef sandwich. Do you remember the corned beef sandwich line in that
song? No. What is the corned beef?
Okay. You know what, Brian? I think you might have a link for Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth.
Oh, here we go.
Let's hear a little bit of this.
I don't.
You don't? Did I not include the link to Twinkle,
I don't
Twinkle,
think
Earth?
So.
All right. Well, you know what? That's.
Hold on.
Maybe I didn't include it, but you know, we're gonna find it. Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth.
Yes.
It's a original music by, of course, William Amadeus Mozart, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And it's one of these spoken word bits where Nimoy as Spock, completely out of character, because he's like, you know, the Vulcan Space Assembly has asked me to come here today to speak to you. And yeah, all right, here we go.
I've been asked to say a few words to Earth people about the stars. You see, I've been there. I came from the planet Vulcan. For centuries, you Earthlings have been starstruck. You've had your lucky star. You kiss when you see the first star at night. You have movie stars. And you wish upon a star. Have you considered the possibility that on a star, the star people wish upon an Earth?
Whoa!
For example, Earthlight.
Hashtag mind blown.
Earthlight. First Earth I see tonight. Or Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth. How I wonder what you're worth. Sounds strange? Well, on Cestus Omicron 3, the all-time hit song is Earth Dust.
Cestus Omicron 3.
Catch a falling Earth. Put it in your pocket.
All right, that's enough. So, yeah, that's Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Earth. Now, I don't know. When I was 13, man, I thought that was a guess. What can I tell you?
It goes on like that for some length afterwards.
Yeah, it's like a 20-minute fish jam. It just goes on and on and on. But the gag specifically was this. Later, he's talking about the president of Vulcan's wife has started a Let's Keep Space Beautiful campaign, And he's talking about space debris. So he says, we have to, remember, this is the height of the space race. So he goes, what about cleaning up after yourselves, Earthlings, like those old nose cones? And he's referring to the initial Mercury rockets and Gemini rockets that, you know, were just left in the space junk. And he says, we have to deal with nose cones and something else, and even the occasional corned beef sandwich. And as he says it, you hear like a clarinet go blah, blah, blah. So it's like a little bit of like a Jewish moment right there.
Yeah.
This is corned beef sandwich. So it's like, that just sounds like just like random babble. Like you're wondering, did Leonard Nimoy have a stroke during this recording and he's just saying things? But the corned beef sandwich line, I later learned, later in life, like 20 years later in life, I learned that that is based in a little bit of reality. I was reading a book about the space race, the big, thick, meaty tome called From the Earth to the Moon, which was what they based that HBO series on, the Tom Cruise one. It's like 1,000 pages long.
Tom Hanks.
Did I say Tom Cruise? I meant Tom Hanks.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Big difference.
Yeah. Big first name, very big stars, very different.
So, early in the space, before the Apollo program, there was a situation where the astronauts, you know, they were always kind of goofing, being goofy, and they would try to sneak things
on. That's what they were known for. Yeah. Big goons. So they went to the moon, but primarily they were always playing pranks.
Well, they were playing a little bit of pranks, and one of them was complaining. I think it was Gus Grissom. Was complaining about the food, right? They had to eat Tang and paste all day, right?
Yeah.
So they were complaining about the food. So one of the guys, I want to say it was Deke Slayton, but I could be mistaken, on the Gemini program, snuck aboard a corned beef sandwich for him to eat in space, right?
Wow. So, it's weird that you would be able to sneak that on board. You figure there would be a couple of checks, seeing as you're going to outer space and you're an astronaut.
Well, now they have these checks. So what happened was somebody snuck, and then he ate his corned beef sandwich in space. And it was like, hey, look at me. And like the NASA guys were like, and this is a little bit the Simpsons gag comes in, like the little clog of the instruments. The NASA guys were like, what the hell? Like, you know, when you eat a sandwich, sometimes a little crumb comes out, especially in zero gravity, will come out of your mouth and might clog the instruments, just like on The Simpsons and when he's eating the potato chips. So it was like a little bit of a controversy. Like, you know, these space cowboys flying around listening. So it became like that was the when he got back to Earth, it was like from now on, you cannot bring shit on board. You got to run it by the boss first. You can't just bring whatever you want. And it was the corned beef sandwich. So, like, the year it happened, like, it was the big news item for a couple of weeks. And, like, I would imagine that Jack Parr and whomever were the, you know, the Jimmy Fallons of the day were making jokes about it. And, like, you know, conservative blowhards were like, these guys think they can do, you know, they don't have to follow rules. They're bringing sandwiches into space.
I blame the Beatles.
So, anyway, topical relevant reference. You know, corned beef sandwich, it makes it onto the Spock album, and it's there now forever, 50 years later. And
it's kind of listening to these, I just kept thinking, like, when they were conceptualizing these albums, I was like, and also, like, you would know better than I would. Was Leonard Nimoy a musician growing up? Did he have aspirations to be a singer? Was it always, like, kind of his deal? Or was it a matter of, you're famous for a TV now, here's a recording contract?
Yeah, no, Leonard Nimoy wanted to make money. He was, and, you know, he had a family.
Shatner, in that respect.
Yeah, no. He did not turn down a damn thing. This is actually discussed in Adam Nimoy's documentary about his father, For the Love of Spock. When he got the gig, he had been a suffering, starving artist for a very long time. And when he finally got the Spock gig, he was like, they want me to appear at a pear festival in Oregon with Spock ears? I'm there. So pretty much while they were shooting Star Trek, he was gone every weekend, squeezing as many Spock dollars as possible out of this. So the recording contract, you know, it started, these were novelty songs like Twinkle Twinkle Little Earth, but he could carry a tune enough that the other albums happen. I mean, the truth of the matter is that some of his vocals, and we'll get to the later albums in a little bit, were not that bad. He sounded a little bit like a Leonard Cohen type, you know?
He had a He had a very interesting voice, and he had a very distinctive voice.
Yeah. You know, his version of If I Were a Carpenter, I swear, I'm not saying it's as good as Johnny Cash's version, but it's not that bad. And some of his later stuff, it's got sort of like a Dylan-esque quality, and, you know,
it was interesting. Because that was one of the songs I heard a while ago, and this was an experience that I had a fair amount listening to the music of Leonard Nimoy. Was I'd hear a song, and I'd be like, wow, I really love this song. I wonder what it sounds like if somebody who can sing was singing it. So for me, that led me to Leon Russell's version, If I Was a Carpenter, which is so funny and like sexy and weird and kind of transgressive. And then you have Leonard Nimoy's version, which again has a quality to it, but it's so earnest and sincere, and If I Was a Carpenter, you know, he's declaiming all of these songs, he's enunciating very clearly. But again, it's an interesting style, and definitely over the course of these five albums, because he kind of goes from, yeah, there definitely is an evolution, and by the end he's kind of doing kind of straight up country politan.
Yeah.
Kind of like overproduced, overly formal, like very excessive sort of country from that period.
Yeah, I mean, he's got sort of like that of the era Grand Ole Opry or like on the Ed Sullivan Show, like that sort of style, you know? It's very produced and very showbiz, right?
Which
is weird because some of the song selections, they were like folk, you know, folk tunes of the day. He did Pete Seeger. He did If I Were a Carpenter and If I Had a Hammer. So he clearly had a thing for tools, right? I mean, there was that. And then, of course, he did the Bilbo Baggins tune, which I'm sure you have some thoughts on, because that's something that's been shared for a long time.
And that's probably his, I mean, that's his, the transformed man. You know, I kind of feel like that is his claim to fame. And it is every bit as kind of surreally misguided as you could possibly imagine. It also seemed like, I don't know, it seemed like sort of geek minds maybe weren't as compartmentalized as they are now back then. So it was like, yes, this is Star Trek, but why can't the big song from it also be about Lord of the Rings?
Exactly.
The clamorous ditty about Lord of the Rings, too. You'd figure a song about Lord of the Rings, you know, it'd be like Prague. It would be serious. You know, you'd have your big orchestration. But instead, it's like one of those like dee, 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 doo, 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 kind of ditties that kind of fill his albums along with, you know, sort of these ponderous anthems and these covers and a lot going on. Not all that transcendent, not all that actually that good, but a lot going on in each of these five albums.
I got to say that I don't much care for the Bilbo Baggins tune. I find it to be really annoying.
It's super annoying, yeah. Kind of intentionally so, almost, you know. It's a real earwig, you know.
Yeah, and there are so many great rock songs about Lord of the Rings. I mean, Zeppelin did one, and Zeppelin did more than one, actually. They mentioned Tolkien things a few times. But before we shift gears and transform over to the great William Shatner, can we, Brian, just hear a little bit of the tune You Are Not Alone, which I genuinely find to be a touching song about, again, it's got that sort of late 60s lush orchestration and that harp and a little bit nice melody.
Have you ever wondered as you gazed up at the sky, watching stars like diamonds shining there on high, that somehow in that great unknown you may find you are not alone.
See, this song, I think, could have been a big hit.
Around
if it was market, let me explain myself. It's the height of the space race. So people are really into the concept of aliens and whatnot. And this is just a sort of an emotional, I don't want to say a love song, but a romantic song about somebody looking for something else to find that you are not alone. And then tweaking a little bit with the science fiction gimmick. You know, it's if the song was not about looking up at the stars and there's talk about other planets, what, and instead it's like gazing out at a meadow or an ocean or whatever, this could have been a pop hit by anyone else of the era. And the singing is almost good enough. His voice is decent. It's not great, but it's decent enough. And there's another universe out there where that song was a big hit. Am I crazy to think that?
No, I mean, it certainly has a certain charm, a certain sophistication, a certain appeal to it. Listening to it just now, I felt like I can see myself, I can see Morrissey covering it. You know, it's got kind of that sort of late 60s, lonely, melancholy, kind of showy, theatrical kind of quality to it. But I could see, I could totally see him doing that, doing justice to it.
Doing justice to it.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
So, Nathan, as someone who's written, you've written a book called My Year of Flops, and you've blogged My World of Flops for years and years, where you celebrate things that are either critically panned or that were commercial failures. Kind of one of the classics in recorded music is William Shatner's The Transformed Man. And you shared with me a moment ago where you said you had never actually listened to it from beginning to end before this week.
I had not. No, I'd heard of it. I'd seen references to it. I'd seen spoofs. I'd seen jokes. And I knew of it, but for some reason, I'd never experienced it myself.
So let's set the scene. You go to your Spotify account. You think, oh, Christ, I got to be on Hoffman's show. What did he wrote me in for? You put on your headphones and what? Tell the listeners about The Transformed Man.
Oh, dear blessed God, where to begin with The Transformed Man? The Transformed Man is an album unlike any other, and that is a very, very good thing, in that half of The Transformed Man consists of William Shatner performing famous soliloquies from classical literature, such as Shakespeare and Cyrano de Bergerac. Then the other half of it is in performing in a similarly melodramatic, similarly self-parodying, similarly hyperventilating, over-the-top style song lyrics of the day, including Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which, you know, the phrase, you need to see it to believe it, you need to hear it to believe it, it gets thrown around an awful lot these days. That is 100% true of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I was laughing long and hard at the song. I just kept thinking, like, where was the person who said, Bill, I know you have a very healthy ego. I know you're quite fond of yourself. I know you think you can do just about anything, and you've got like this weird recitation thing going on. This is a terrible idea. This isn't just a terrible idea. This is like a series of terrible ideas glued together to form like a Voltron terrible idea. Because it's him doing Shakespeare, which theoretically that's kind of his wheelhouse. He's an actor. Even that's a terrible idea. No, you're showing to the world that you're not a good actor. You're showing to the world that you're everything people make fun of you about. You're not helping yourself.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you, because if it was a terrible idea, we wouldn't still be talking about it.
That is true. It's there are some terrible ideas. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the day the clown cried, and I don't think that anybody is talking about that as a wonderful idea that should have been, you know, brought into the world. I would say all it would need would be, you know, being completely inaccessible in order to be the day the clown cried.
You know what? Let's hear a few moments from the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. That's sort of the classic track. Brian, can we cue that one up? Now, this comes out of a recitation of, I think it's Baudelaire's poetry.
Yeah.
And then he goes from Baudelaire into... All right, so far not so bad.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you. You answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. For the girl with a sun in her eyes. And she's gone!
She's gone! She's gone! She's gone! Oh, God, no more. Well, you know, let me tell you something. Risk is our business. You know, yeah. That's what Captain Kirk always said. You're going to do it. You're going to do it big. You're going to recite Shakespeare and Baudelaire and Cyrano de Bergerac, and then you're going to go into an overproduced weirdo recitation of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds with echo effects.
Yeah.
And do it and overmodulate it too. I mean, just belt it out. No second take on that. Just belt it out.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a hell of a thing. And it's not just that. It's also Mr. Tambourine Man is on there. And
His ideas about what songs are fascinating to me, because with him and Leonard Nimoy, they're approaching these songs as actors. So they're like, where is the drama? Where is the conflict within this song? So like, for example, Mr. Tambourine Man, he seems to be stalking Mr. Tambourine Man. He seems intent on killing Mr. Tambourine Man. He's just like yelling, Tambourine Man!
Yeah, he is. He's like, it's almost like, have you seen Mr. Tambourine Man?
It's like, I think he's like a musical like the children enjoy. I'm not sure that he's like a Mike Myers, Jason Voorhees type figure. I want to know what was going on inside William Shatner's mind when he conceptualized this and when he performed it.
It's hard to know. I mean,
and also, who are the adults who said, this is a good idea, we're going to bankroll this, and then we're going to distribute it professionally?
Well, I mean, he wasn't alone. He did have producers working with him, a fellow by the name of Don Ralk, and the instrumentations were written by, I believe, a fellow by the name of Frank Davenport. So, you know, he had some co-conspirators in all this, you know, and sometimes you get a bunch of people together and they try something new and it doesn't always work out. You know, the other track on there, which is amazing, is the It Was a Very Good Year with the Sinatra tune, right?
Yeah.
And he sounds so like it was like he's like a lawyer in court. Explaining how the year was good, you know, like, damn it, it was a very good year, and here are my reasons why. And it's
there's almost something a little bit Trumpian in his delivery there, where he's like bragging about what a good year it was for 17-year-old girls. That's the other thing. Again, we've been talking about, you know, sort of the divide between acting and music, and you look at Frank Sinatra, who kind of the opposite of that, where he was a brilliant singer and he was an actor in his singing, and he kind of performed the emotions, he performed, you know, it embodied his characters, and he went on to, you know, segue into being like a very good, very naturalistic, very realistic actor. Whereas with William Shatner, you have the opposite thing going on, where you're an incredibly hammy and incredibly stylized actor, and then you go over to music, sort of, and not only do you like not, I don't know, cede any ground, but you turn music into this bizarre sort of cathedral for your unique style of acting.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is very unique. There are not many albums like The Transformed Man, and you know, it's hard to listen to all the way through. It's a bit much, you know. It's not mellifluous, but it's so strange, and it comes from, I really do think that it came from a really good place. He wanted to do something new. You know, he saw his colleague Nimoy doing an album, and the first one, as we mentioned, was a little bit more gimmick than singer-songwriter stuff. It was a lot of the gimmick stuff. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. He doesn't perform as Kirk in this, although the name on the record when it first came out, it said William Shatner, sort of parentheses, the, you know, Star Trek's Captain Kirk. So that was the marketing was there, but he doesn't perform as the captain. There's nothing science fiction about this. He said, you want me to do an album? I'm going to do a thing that plays to my strengths, which is Shakespeare soliloquy. And I think his Henry V bit is okay. I mean, It's kind of cool.
It's big,
but it's all right. You know, I don't know. It is what it is.
I was not bored by the.
No, you were not bored.
I would definitely, if I were to do it for my World of Flops, which I couldn't because it's too much of a cult success, it would definitely be a secret success because I laughed a lot. There's nothing like it. It definitely deserves to exist, in part so that you can wonder how it can exist.
That's totally fair. Like, I want to know, you know, of the people, like, what, you know, just how, you know, the producer of this thing, just how spaced out on drugs was he when he allowed those echoey sound effects, you know? But then the other thing is, you know, it is totally on his own terms. And then that was it. He did this and that was it. And then he didn't really record again until he was already famous William Shatner. He did some sort of voiceover stuff with symphony orchestras for original works where he did the narration. And then he did, as we mentioned earlier, the Ben Folds stuff. And then later, the songs where he was sort of tweaking his own self-image. The other... go ahead.
There was an album from 2013 called Behold the Mystery. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but I was kind of going through my internet rabbit hole on there. And it's pretty fascinating. It's him basically still doing his spoken word thing, but with a bunch of like kind of musical virtuosos. So you'll have Stevie Vai doing his Stevie Vai thing, and then Shatner will be intoning space poetry kind of thing, but without sort of Ben Folds there to kind of lend, you know, a certain element of irony to it, a certain bittersweet quality to it, a certain self-consciousness, a certain kind of wry dance between sort of camp and sincerity. Whereas when it's just William Shatner and all these weird old dudes, there's nothing like that. It's just pure self-parody. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that album, I do remember when that came out, and it wasn't as fun as the Ben Folds one.
No. If left to his own devices, he will create something that sometimes is bizarrely fascinating, and people talk about it forever because it's so hilariously terrible.
Yeah.
The transfer man, and then sometimes, you know, he'll do something and it'll just be off.
Did a dog just jump on a computer there?
No, my dog just barked because the monsters you come by every 3 o'clock with the wind blowers are here crying out of their
round view
here.
Well, you know, another thing, you know, Shatner, maybe this is another episode. Shatner has directed his fair share of motion pictures, and you know, his last most recent output has been a lot of these documentaries about Star Trek, including The Captains, which is probably the most famous one. But he also did put out a movie called Groom Lake, which co-starred the late Dick Van Patten, and is a science fiction conspiracy film. Excuse me, that is one of the most fascinating bits of outsider art you'll ever see. And it was made, I guess, in the late 1990s, although it didn't actually get released until like 2008 or so. And in it, the League of Evil, Nefarious Future Scientists, they dominate the globe and launch NASA rockets from their IMAX because they were the new IMAX that had just come out that were blue. Remember those? And they were like kind of spooky and weird looking. So that is that's the one thing I really remember from Groom Lake. It's a bed of IMAX. So yeah. So, you know, we got to start wrapping this up. But Nathan, there's one very important William Shatner performance that we really need to discuss. And it wasn't on the Transform Man, which was recorded in 68. But it was an event that happened in 1978 at the science fiction
The Science Fiction Film Awards?
The Science Fiction Film Awards in 1978 when I believe it was Karen Allen gave an award to Bernie Taupin, who of course was Elton John's co-writer, for writing the lyrics to Rocket Man. And Bernie Taupin said, thank you very much for this award, blah, blah, blah. And now to help, celebrate Rocket Man, I introduce to you William Shatner, who was wearing a tuxedo, sitting on a stool, and sucking on a cigarette, and he gave a dramatic reading of Rocket Man. Now, Nathan, I'm sure you're familiar with this clip, yes?
Oh my God, yes, I certainly am. That's another one that I have laughed long and hard about, and it gave me a lot of joy. So thank you, William Shatner, for that.
Yeah. Now, Brian, when I sent in the clip earlier today, he knew it only from Family Guy. You didn't know it was a real thing, right?
I'm trying to think back if I did or not, but I mean, I wasn't as familiar with... the first time I saw it was Family Guy, absolutely. I may have gone back at some point and looked at it, but my definite first exposure was Family Guy, and I was very confused at the time.
So let's just hear a moment or two. Let's hear at least up until when he gets high as a kite.
Pack my bag. Last night, pre-flight.
Pre-flight.
0 hour. 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high. As a kite by then.
Could you just imagine being in the audience for this?
Imagine the mortification.
I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely. Out in space.
Do you think he's winging it or did he rehearse it?
On such a tired flight. And I think it's going to be a long, long time to touchdown. Brings me back again.
God bless you, William Shatner.
Not the man they think I am back home. Oh, no, no, no. I'm a rocket man.
Now, I believe here's where on the video it's like it freeze frames and he walks away from himself.
Burning out his fuse.
Not quite yet. It's a little further in, but... Oh, yeah, there it goes.
I think it's going to be a long, long time. Till touchdown, bring me round again and fine. I'm not the man they think I am. Oh, no. I'm a rocket man.
So good.
Rocket man. Burning out his fuse out here alone.
Do you want a captain who plays it safe all the time? And only you want a captain who's going to go on an award show and just, you know... go to warp 10 and do something crazy, you know, and memorable.
You want a rocket man for captain. You don't want some boring, normal dude who doesn't do things that are completely insane for some reason.
No, it's the right thing.
Satisfy his creative muse.
It really is something special. I mean, the alchemy in the stew between Shatner and Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and Roddenberry and Gene Kunin, and all these different personalities. It's a stew that could never be recreated. That's what makes Star Trek so magical. I mean, you know, they tried Star Trek without Shatner, Jeffrey Hunter. It didn't work. You need William Shatner for Star Trek. You know,
he was Jesus.
Yeah, that's right. Jeffrey Hunter was Jesus. And even he wasn't good enough.
William Shatner could do.
You know, it really is. So it's easy to make fun of Shatner. And then, you know, he got it. You know, eventually his second half of his career, his post-Star Trek career, Denny Crane, which, you know, on its own is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, that was an extremely popular show. He made, you know, won Emmy Awards and made a boatload of money. And then the Priceline gig kind of fed off of Rocket Man. Really, that persona of this weird type of, this guy has no, you know, he'll do anything. He's daring enough to do anything. He's proud of his abilities. And he's going to do it. He's going to sit on stage in a tuxedo and speak Rocket Man at you. And that's why he's great. And Nimoy also, you know, he would do that.
He's living life to the fullest.
Now, it's time for us to go. We've had you on the horn for a while, Nathan. I want to thank you so much. But before we let you go, Brian, there was one more track I sent you, which was just called Alien, which was the spoken word piece. Can we hear the beginning of this? And then we'll say goodbye to Nathan, who's going to go back to Nathan Rabin's happy place where he's reviewing every Weird Al Yankovic song ever recorded. Does that include the B-sides and the demos?
Well, actually, one of the things that kind of spawned this is he's putting out a career-spawning box set cased within an accordion. one of the discs on it is going to be a rarities and B-sides disc, a bunch of songs that have never been released before. So I don't know why I'm plugging his work, as he's very successful. But check that out in September. It's been a wonderful experience.
Awesome.
And it's only getting better.
Well, that's at NathanRaven.com. So, Brian, let's hear a little bit about
some other stuff.
From the land of endless night come I, an alien from afar, spewn forth onto your pleasant sphere, so much like you and yet so unlike. I believe that's how it begins.
From the land of endless night come I, an alien from afar, spewn forth upon you a pleasant sphere, so much like you, and yet so unlike.
Wow. Am I the you that you once were? The you when your world was new?
Am I the you before? The you you were when your world was new? Or am I the you that you will be tomorrow? Through me you see your future or your past. I know not which. For I come from that spark of light so far in space, your mind the distance could not comprehend.
This is poetry.
It was once my home.
I love that fiddler on the roof.
And calls to me when I look up into the void.
Yeah, awesome.
But it is not the verdant place your planet is that warms and cools you as the seasons go.
Oh no.
Oh no. My mind recalls a seething cauldron flung among the stars and satellites and galaxies of boundless time.
All right. The stars and galaxies of boundless times. Nathan, thanks again for joining us. If listeners want to follow you on Twitter, is it just your name or do you have a catchy handle there?
Nope, it's just Nathan Raven.
Okay, not like Nathan C. Raven or N. Raven 66.
Just Nathan Raven.
All right, good. Well, they can do that. And they should. Yeah, definitely go to NathanRaven.com, which is, a relatively new website, which is backed by Patreon. So it means that Nathan can do all the weird underbelly of culture stuff without having to have editors say yes to his pitches. And if you like reading his stuff, and you probably do, you can give as little as a dollar a month, and you can be one of his patrons and know that you're doing the right thing. So... I want to say thank you so much for coming on. This was all I could hope for and more. I'm glad I made you listen to The Legend of Bilbo Baggins and The Transformed Man.
Thanks so much.
All right, cool. So, Nathan, again, thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.